Welcome to the Caving Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Pelser, chairman of the Central Indiana Grotto. Greetings, conventioneers. If you're listening to this at the NSS National Convention in Montana, I wish I were there with you. One of these days I'll make it to convention. This is, I hope, an episode people will be talking about at convention. More on that in a minute. If you've stumbled upon this podcast and you're interested in cave exploration, you just heard me use the word grotto. That's what we call a local chapter of our national organization, the NSS, the National Speleological Society. I highly recommend, if you want to do this, that you become affiliated with a grotto so that you can learn the proper techniques, make some friends, go on some good trips, do it the right way. Caving is not dangerous if you know what you're doing, but it is if you don't. So take the proper precautions, gear up, learn from the best, and you can find your local grotto at the NSS website, which is caves.org. Easy to remember, caves.org. My guest this month is, as you saw, Swego founder Scott McCray, who has been on the podcast before about a year ago when I did the special episode all on cave packs. Most of the content was taken from interviews that he did with other cave pack makers and authorities. And then I did a quick interview with him on Swego and how that came about. But in this episode, we go into his caving life. But we touch on Swego a bit at the end of the episode. Of course, Swego was one of our first sponsors here at the Caving Podcast. I want to tell you about our current sponsor, Organic Robot on Etsy. He's going to be busy this month and next month. Charlie Vetters is who I'm talking about. He is the organic robot, you might say. Designer and maker of some of the best, most original t-shirts to feature caving and other outdoor activities. Check out the Caving Where the Real Stuff Happens t-shirt and sweatshirt. I got the sweatshirt. Camping Hair Don't Care, like that one. And of course, the ever popular Nice Rack. And of course, you can order any of his designs at the Etsy store, but he's going to be at Indiana Cave Capers August 17th through the 19th and OTR Labor Day weekend. So hit up Charlie for some great shirts and show off your love of caving to the world. And a special bonus, he's offering to anyone who pre-registers for Indiana Cave Capers, our event coming up, an exclusive Caving Podcast sticker to all Capers pre-registrations. You can, of course, do that at caves, CIGcaves.com. CIG, our grotto, the Central Indiana Grotto, CIGcaves.com. And again, to order from Charlie, visit Organic Robot on Etsy. All one word, Organic Robot. I actually got to go caving recently. Last weekend, I finally visited Binkley Cave, Indiana's longest cave, currently at over 44 miles. Laura Demarest, who's been on the podcast, led that trip. I had a great time. Also, first time I've actually met a big promoter of the podcast, Ray Maslach, who runs the blog Exploring This Blue Dot. Great to finally meet you, Ray. Lots of other great folks, Nick, Rachel, Naburu. Excellent trip. Look forward to another trip with some of you fine folks again here real soon. All right, without further ado, let's get to Scott. So Scott McCray is a member of the Flittermouse Grotto, North Carolina. Big caver, very involved with the NCRC as well. And he invented the ever-popular Swego pack, one of the best cave packs out there. Of course, he ran into supply problems with the material and had to quit making Swegos a couple of years ago. This month, in addition to talking about his caving life, and he's led a very interesting and entertaining caving life worth hearing about, he will update you on the current progress toward finding new material to make Swegos from. If you follow Swego on social media, you know that he's been testing new materials, giving prototype packs to cavers to put through their paces, and he's made some developments. Things are looking good, and we'll talk about it later. So here he is, Scott McCray. When did you start caving?
Well, I went into my first cave when I was 12 years old in the Boy Scouts. We went to Glade Cave in Augusta County, Virginia. It's a very popular first cave for a lot of people. And we went in, I don't know, 50, 100 feet, and it was completely sumped water to the ceiling. And we had no idea. None of us had ever been in this cave before. We just heard about it. So we thought it was cool anyway. We got to go in a cave 100 feet. After I became a caver, I went back and discovered there's like 4,000 feet of passage there. So it's actually an interesting cave. It's full of slimy mud because it floods to the ceiling. but it's a fun little cave.
How often or how much of Glade Cave have you now seen?
Oh, we saw it all in high school. We went there a couple of times, and we used to go in the entrance and turn right. Every time we came to a spot where we could turn right, we turned right, and eventually we'd end up back at the entrance. So we figured we saw absolutely everything in the cave.
So it's a circle route.
No, it's got, you know, branches, but we just go all the way down one branch until we couldn't go any further, and we'd go down the other side. If there was a right-hand turn, we'd take it.
That's one that's been completely pushed. That's pretty known.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
What are some of your favorite caves that you've ever come across?
I guess I have sort of a top three or four or something like that. My favorite cave is Cyclops Cave in Virginia. It's got a lot of everything. I was involved with the discovery of it, so it's kind of special that way too. But I think my second favorite is Ellison's. There's just so much in there that's amazing. And there's a cave in near Bristol, Tennessee, Bristol, Virginia, that's called Worley's Cave, and that's kind of the local cave for where we are here in North Carolina. That's where we take all our first-timers and newbie trips. You know, it's the Buckners of East Tennessee. You know, I've done, you know, 100, 150 trips in there probably, but there's some great stuff in there, and I just like it. And it's fun to take new people in there to show them what caving's all about.
This is a little self-serving for me since I'm based in Indiana, but what have you done in Indiana that you've liked?
Well, I was there for the convention in 07.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And we did, I'm terrible with names of caves, but one that we canoed in the entrance.
There's a few of them down there like that.
Yeah. We canoed in several hundred feet to a beach, and we had one or two canoes, and we just kept ferrying people back and forth. Took over an hour to get everybody in, but it was cool. That's the first time I ever canoed in a cave. And what else did we do? We did several. There's I think it connects to Binkley's. There's a real small entrance, just a crack in the rock that blew a lot of air. And
not blowing hole.
Maybe
blowing hole. I'm actually not familiar. I mean, I've heard of it and I've seen numerous presentations and heard a lot of people talk about it, but I don't know what the entrance looks like. So it could very well be that one.
Could be, because we went in there. It was real tight and a lot of breakdown crawls. And eventually we got down in the stream passage and it turned into a huge borehole, you know, 50 feet high and 40 feet wide or so.
But what grottos do you belong to? Do you just belong to one or do you belong to several?
No, just one, the Flittermouse Grotto in Asheville. Yep, that's the only one. I started, my first organized caving grotto was the Cleveland Grotto in Cleveland, Ohio. So I went to college at Kent State. I caved, you know, in high school. And when I went off to college, I was curious to know if there were any caves in Ohio. I had no idea.
There's like five, right?
Yeah.
Not that many. So,
I went to the local outdoor store and asked the sales guy there, and he's like, well, there's a flyer over here on the bulletin board. It said it was a cave for pay business, you know, pay $100 or whatever and it'll take you caving. So I called the guy up and told him I don't want to pay to go caving, I just want to go caving. He said, well, if that's the case, you just come to a grotto meeting. He was I think it was Kurt Holler, who's now vice president of the NSS, that I had talked to, and said, yeah, just come on up to a grotto meeting. So I did, and joined, and they took me on my first organized caving trip, and it's been pretty exciting ever since.
it's been ever since. Have you ever been involved in like grotto leadership?
Oh, yeah. Been vice chair. I was chair for 4 years in a row. Currently, I'm the safety and training officer. So, and I've been newsletter editor and never have been treasurer. They don't trust me with money. So.
I would take that as a positive, because I would hate to be treasurer. It's just the hardest job.
It is, absolutely.
I admire anybody who can do it and do it well. So these days, what do you find yourself doing a lot of as far as caves that you visit over and over again or areas that you're frequenting?
So back in 2009, so it was, you know, prime white nose era.
Totally.
We had stopped caving for a while, and one of our buddies in Virginia had said he had talked to a farmer that had a cave on his property and wanted to know if we'd come check it out. So John and Wes went up there and met the landowner. He's a good old Virginia farmer. Took both of them out in the field, and the story goes that the farmer pointed over on this bluff past the field and said, "You see that over there?" And John's like, "I don't know. What are you looking at?" And the farmer ended up grabbing John's head, putting his chin on a fence post, and turning his head. Say, "You see that tree?" John's like, "Yeah." Yes. The farmer said, "It's right under that tree." So they walked over there. But no, as they were leaving, the landowner said, "Now, you boys be careful over there, because last time I was running around over there chasing a cow at about dusk, came around the corner, and there was something standing there in the trail looking straight at me, and it only had one eye."
All right.
He was dead serious. And so, you know, John and Wes just kind of laughed it off and went over and looked at this cave. And sure enough, it's a little 10, 12-foot entrance pit that they hand-line down into, and it leads to a constriction that is just blowing a ton of air.
Hmm.
So shimmy down through that, got to another constriction that they couldn't get through, but it was just blowing lots and lots of air. So they came back and told me about it, and we went back and used some chemical persuasion to make an entrance into the cave, and now we're still surveying it, but we're up over 7 miles of passage.
Really?
So,
wow.
Get 11 drops to get to the bottom of the cave. it's pretty cool. Some great stuff in that cave. So we actually have a zip line set up across a lake. So we don't have to go down in the lake anymore. We just zip across it.
Oh my God. Excuse, I'm sure, to get to the other side of that.
Yep.
How long does it take then to get to where you're surveying? I mean, do you have leads going on all directions or one major one?
The farthest reaches of the survey are now five and a half hours from the entrance.
Wow. So it's a big day. I mean, it's a full day if you go and do it.
Yeah, they're 18, 24-hour trips. So.
Wow. And what cave is this?
It's called Cyclops.
This is Cyclops. Okay, this is Cyclops we're talking about. Awesome.
Yep. That's the one-eyed thing.
Oh, the one-eyed thing.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Does the landowner approve of the name?
Oh, yeah. He loves it.
Yeah. Nice. Anything else around there? I mean, it's 7 miles? It's a 7-mile cave. There's got to be something else around there.
There's not really right near there. There's more stuff in that county. But it's definitely the longest cave in the county. And it's one of those areas that cavers have been looking at for years. You know, it's on a road called Sinkhole Valley Road.
Oh, yeah, all right.
And
it's indicative.
There's springs and blind valleys and sinkholes everywhere. And everybody knew there was a cave there somewhere, but nobody knew how to get into it. We just kind of lucked onto it, so.
Said like what, 10, 11 drops? So there's a pretty significant vertical element to it.
Yeah, it's 420 feet deep, something like that total.
Wow.
The longest drop, though, is right about 40 feet.
So
most of them are 20, 25 feet.
Wow. All right.
It's kind of nice because you don't have to, you know, you don't tire yourself out climbing.
Yeah.
But you still get to do all the rope stuff. There's lots of rebelays and redirects and.
Any really tough parts, long crawls or anything like that that you just don't look forward to every time you go back?
There's a great video that we took, I took after a trip. Lots of people out there will know Mud Puppy.
Yeah.
He's a tag caver.
Yeah.
But we took him in a couple of years ago. There's been a motto for first-time Cyclops cavers for a long time. I don't know if you want to bleep this or not, but the Cyclops motto is this cave.
Okay, well, so, if cavers are saying that, it must be pretty tough.
Yeah, so Mud Puppy's first trip in there, we're coming out the entrance, you know, that 10, 12-foot handline pit. And he gets up onto the edge and sits down, and I've got my camera going. And I'm like, so what'd you think, Mud Pup? And he's like, this cave. it's great. So, but everybody goes back, and you start to love it. It's the entrance series is tight and tight vertical slots, and they're muddy, and the rope's muddy. And
so that's what's kind of primarily tough about it is just that right there.
Yeah. I mean, you spend 5.5 hours traveling from the back of the cave, and 90% of it you're walking.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the last 400 feet are torturous. So, you know, I've seen it take people 5 hours to do the last 400 feet.
Oh, my God. Really?
But, yeah, most people do it in about an hour.
That must be rough if you're with those people that took 5 hours.
Oh,
you've
yeah.
been in and out of there a million times.
Yeah.
You're just waiting on them.
But it's still fun because they're, you know, it's fun to watch people struggle sometimes.
So do you have then when you're going through that tough part at the beginning, do you have like, I mean, it must be like second nature to you now, like, okay, bend this way, go low, go high, do this, do that,
oh, yeah.
you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And then you're able to get through it in an hour.
Yeah.
An hour.
Yeah, definitely.
Feet. How often do you get there?
We used to go once a month back, you know, from 2009 probably to 2013, we went once a month. That was our white nose caving.
Right,
we
right.
Just, that was all we did was Cyclops Cave during those prime white nose years. So now that, you know, white nose is kind of is damaged and we figured out the decontamination thing and extra gear, all that stuff, we're starting to spread our wings a little more. So, you know, there's other things out there besides Cyclops now. So we're going back to Cyclops about maybe 4 times a year. So
how did white nose, I mean, I only know how white nose has affected us here in Indiana and a little bit elsewhere, but how did it affect caving in, you said, Virginia and North Carolina? I mean, were there state right. laws that were enacted that reduced access severely or anything like that?
Well, private property was still available. All the state land, federal land, they just put a blanket closure on everything.
Is that still in effect?
Tell people not to go in caves. Technically, yes.
Yeah.
Just about everywhere. So there's some pockets where they've opened it back up. But so private land was pretty much the only option. And a lot of us just quit caving until they figured out what it was. We didn't want to contribute to spreading it. If it was cave or spread, we just didn't know. So we just didn't go for, it was probably 6 months or a year where we just didn't do any caving. We did vertical stuff and, you know, some ridge walking, but just didn't go in caves.
Mm-hmm.
So then we, you know, we found Cyclops and we're like, cool, we're just going to go here.
Yeah, that Cyclops project turned up at just the right time then.
It did, like. Absolutely.
You're able to focus all your energy on that. I mean, if it sounds crappy to say, but if had it not been for White Nose, maybe Cyclops wouldn't be as long as it is today.
That's a good point. Yeah, you're right.
So what else is on your list of discoveries?
That's probably the most significant discovery we've made. We've made a number of smaller caves, all less than a mile, around Northeast Tennessee and Virginia. We found a couple in North Carolina, but they're all in granite, so they're fissure caves instead of solutional caves. So they're smaller. You know, if we find a 200-foot cave in granite, we're pretty excited. Yeah, so nothing real significant that we've found. Nothing that anybody would really want to go back to. So.
And just put it on the list and never go back.
Right.
Would you say you have a trip or maybe a series of trips that you look back on and think, man, that was the hardest one I've ever done, or could be the hardest one I've ever done or will ever do?
Yeah. I did a trip to Mammoth one time, the CRF, you know, went to Hamilton Valley and got hooked up with those guys and, you know, got assigned to go to Proctor Cave with several other folks. And we were going to survey some stream passage. Yeah, I'd never been there. This is my first time caving in Mammoth at all. So I was pretty excited and didn't know what to expect. They said there was a crawl at the beginning, and they said it was about 1,000 feet. And we'd done some 1,000-foot crawls in East Tennessee before, so I was like, all right, I can handle that. And turns out that it was, you know, a regular belly crawl for 1,000 feet, but it was very sandy. The floor was pretty much covered in sand, and I just got torn up by that sand. It got under my elbow pads, under my knee pads, everywhere. I was covered in sand, and I couldn't move without it being like sand. I was wearing a sandpaper coveralls made out of sandpaper.
Sounds miserable.
Oh, it was horrible. So, and then we had to, you know, we surveyed for 6 or 8 hours, and then we turned around and had to go back through it. it was bad.
That's just such a morale shot, you know, when that happens. It's like, oh, God, I got to go back through that again. Right. The hell with that. What about one that was really difficult at the time, but you look back on it so fondly? Because, see, like me, like the best trip I've ever been on is also what I consider to be the most challenging, you know, physically demanding. I'm a glutton for punishment.
There's been some caves that I don't want to go back to for sure. One of them in Northeast Tennessee called Pearson Cave. It's not a big cave, you know, maybe 1,000 feet of passage, but it's got a lot of bats that use that cave. There was another cave very near there, the adjacent property that we were surveying that we had found, and it's heading that direction. So we were hoping that it was going to connect to Pearson. So we went in Pearson to try to find a new lead that would connect over to this Lonesome Pine cave we were surveying. We'd never been in there and went in not knowing what to expect. So it turns out there was bat guano everywhere.
Oh.
And it's moldy bat
guano. Oh, God.
You know, that white furry piles, you know, the fur that grows up about 3 or 4 inches and everywhere. You could barely take a step through the cave without stepping in it. And
at least you're not crawling in it or something.
Oh, we did.
Oh, you did?
Oh, God. Oh, there was a dead deer in the entrance.
Oh,
we had to step through.
Yeah. Anything like that where you're dealing with excrement and dead animals.
Yep.
It's a no-go.
There's one where we found some what we think are Native American remains.
Oh, really? Human remains?
Yeah, in Southwest Virginia. There's actually several caves up there with human remains, presumably Native American. And we found one. We dug into it. It was on a farmer's field, and there were some rocks pushed in the entrance. And, you know, we moved 4 or 5 rocks and big enough to get into. So it was pretty easy to dig. And got into a room, you know, about the size of a garage or so. And there's a hole in the floor that's full of rocks, too, but blowing pretty good air. So we moved those rocks and dropped down in a long, about 100-foot slope going pretty steeply down. We had to use a hand line to get down, but I was going down first and found a bone that I thought was cow, you know, femur or leg or something like that.
Sure.
And I was looking at it, I was like, man, that's a long, skinny cow bone. And I picked it up. And I was like, oh, wait a minute. That's probably human.
Oh,
and started looking around some more and found some ribs and found some pieces of skull and part of a jawbone. And
oh, my goodness.
Yeah, we ended up finding, we think there were 2, maybe 3 bodies in there.
Wow.
So we came out and told the landowner.
I was going to say, you have to report right?
Yeah, we took some pictures and came out and showed the landowner, told him about it. You know, we told him that we have some friends at East Tennessee State University that would love to come in and look at it, that do paleontology and archaeology and that sort of thing, and are cavers and would love to find some of that stuff in the cave. And he's like, nope, don't want to tell anybody about it.
Oh.
He said, I'll just keep it a secret. So we came back one more time, made a map, and that's the last we've been to that cave.
So. Yeah. Is that the last anybody's been to that cave?
Yeah.
Secret's safe with you and with him.
Right. Yeah.
My goodness. Is that the only time you've ever run into like human remains?
Well, we've seen there's a cave sort of near Cyclops that has a footprint that they think is Native American. It's got a 50-foot entrance pit. So we're not sure how they got in there, but you know, we've had those guys from East Tennessee State come look at it, and they agree. They think it's 1,000 years old or so. But that's as close as we've come to human remains. We did dig into a cave in Northeast Tennessee. It was right on the side of the road, farm road, and we're digging in it. And I pull up a rock, and under this rock was something that looked metal. I could tell it was round, kind of ball-shaped, and had a almost like a button or a ring or on the top of the ball. And I looked at it for a second, and I didn't touch it. And I called my buddy down, and I was like, "What is that?" He's like, "I don't know." And I said, "Do you think that's a landmine?" it's got the little trigger button on top. Yeah. It's round. And it's like, that's what landmines look like, isn't it? He's like, "Yeah, I think so." So we thought for sure it was a landmine, that was buried in a cave like 4 feet down. We'd already dug down about 4 feet. Like, why would there be a landmine down here?
Exactly.
So I think we switched spots, and he started digging around it.
We'd be digging around a landmine, potential landmine or not.
So Jimmy's a little braver than I am, and he kind of dug around it and, cleared it out so we could see how big it is, and dug, very carefully, like a Egyptologist with the paintbrush, pushing the dust away with the paintbrush and that gentle. Got it uncovered enough. He's like, "Hey, come down here and look at this." And we look at it from a couple angles, and we're like, "Yeah, yeah, that's definitely an old copper float from a toilet."
You got us.
Yeah,
you got us.
But we thought for sure it was a landmine for quite a while.
Oh my God!
So it's landmine float cave.
Is that what it is? That's great.
Yeah. The other stuff I'm doing caving related, I do a lot of bat survey work for the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Every winter they do surveys of the caves of North Carolina, and they count the bats just to keep track of how they're doing. And I've been kind of their safety consultant, cave expert for 15, 16 years, I guess. So every January, February, I pretty much spend 2 or 3 days a week underground looking for bats. It's pretty fun. I get to see all the caves in North Carolina that are closed because of white nose, because they're on federal state property. They let the biologists go in just to count bats, and I get to take them and make sure they're safe and make sure they get out.
So when you're dealing with stuff like that, I mean, my guess is if you're dealing with biologists who are specializing in bats, that they're used to, they've been in caves before.
Not necessarily.
So, okay. So then how do you deal with that when you're with somebody who is in the environment, who's not really used to having been in caves? Have you ever run into any trouble, any specific challenges to that?
We do, like the current biologist, Catherine is her name. She was, she got her degree in biology with her master's is in bats, I guess. I don't know.
Sure.
I don't know how that stuff works, but she studied bats in college.
Sure.
And she had been to some mines where there were bats and done a lot of the mist netting where they catch bats outside at night. When they fly around, they hit the mist net and slide down the strings into a basket, and then they pick them up and examine them, put the band on if that's what they're doing, identify them, all that stuff, and then let them go. So you can do a lot of stuff with bats without ever going into a cave. And when she started doing the bat survey work with me, she had been in one cave. I did some training with her. Got to make sure she had the right gear, knew what to expect, how to deal with moving through caves, especially in North Carolina. They're kind of small and tight. So, we started with some easy ones and kind of worked her way up. She's just did her third year of the bat survey this past winter, and she's an old pro now.
So no real mental hurdle for her?
Well, there's been some challenging spots for her, for sure. She's progressed great over the last 3 years. Yeah, she's turned into a tough little caver.
Nice. Very cool. Yeah. Is it anything she'd want to pick up as a hobby?
Oh, I think she already has.
Oh, really? Yeah. Wow. Well, cool. Yeah.
She's not as hardcore as we are, but sure. She'll definitely go on a cave trip or two.
So I imagine you have to, you know, when you're dealing with that sort of thing, you have to be diligent in following decon procedures.
Yeah. So we, one thing, the requirements for us to be able to do the surveys are we have to have, if it's a vertical cave at all, we have to have ropes and vertical gear that are specific for that cave.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So the Wildlife Commission has like 4 sets of vertical gear for 6 or 7, 8 caves, something like that, and ropes just for those caves. So there's quite a bit of added expense to comply with all the regulations and requests from the landowners. We wear 2 Tyvek suits to try to contain the cave from our bodies, with the hood, and we have to duct tape rubber gloves to the Tyvek wrists and duct tape rubber boots to the Tyvek cuffs of the pant legs.
That probably gets hot.
Yeah. Well, luckily we're in a cave and it's wintertime. It's not too bad. Looking for bats, you're kind of trying to move slowly and be quiet. So you're not moving real fast.
I guess what I was trying to get at is when you are doing like white nose decon, what's mm-hmm. your preferred method? There's a few of them out there. And whenever people ask, I never know what to tell them. I say, the procedures are online, it's right. Whatever you have. Yeah. What do you prefer to use?
We've been, the Wildlife Commission specifically was using, they've done some of the 409.
Yeah.
Was an option for a while. Mostly they were doing bleach, the 10% bleach solution.
That's what we do at Capers.
Yeah. And then just recently they've started doing the hot water. Mm. I think that's kind of the preferred method now is the hot water.
Yeah. No chemicals. Just right. Make sure the water's hot enough.
Yep. So a turkey fryer works great for heating up a bunch of water.
I guess you're right. Yeah. Yeah. It makes perfect sense.
Yeah. I guess the only other thing I've been doing, I became a NCRC instructor in 2014.
Hmm.
So I've been teaching lots of NCRC classes since then. It's been fantastic. I learned so much more teaching the classes than I did even, taking the classes.
Well, so who's your point person in like your region, or does Anmar come down there for that and all his people?
Well, for the national week-long seminar.
Sure.
Anmar and everybody from Indiana and all over the country come together wherever the week-long seminar is. And we teach, 8 days worth of cave rescue classes, which turns into basically Disneyland for cavers. That you're caving or talking about caving or practicing caving for 8 days in a row, like 14 hours a day. It's just great. Your food's provided, usually lodging's provided. So it's kind of like a vacation, but you get to go caving the whole time.
Yeah, yeah.
And you get to hang out with awesome cavers too.
And learn how to be a better caver.
Exactly, yeah.
So you'll be in Corydon, Indiana next year.
Yeah, right. Yeah. We expect to see you there.
I would love to be there. I would love to try to make it. And I know that at Capers, we are going to have some NCRC people. I know Laura is involved, and I know that Danielle Green is going to be with Laura. And they're going to have like a table set up near registration where they are going to have like silent auction items and things like that. And they're going to have sort of a scholarship fundraiser for people who might not be able to afford the expense of week long, which is what, like $600 or $700, something like that.
Yep.
And we're gonna do some scholarship fundraising at Capers this year for that.
Yeah.
So it's a big deal. I mean, for it to be in Indiana is fun for us and cool, and we want to support it.
Yeah, that scholarship has been fantastic for a lot of people. I'm glad you're supporting that.
Yeah, it's our pleasure because those are our friends, and you know, we know Anmar and we see him all the time, and you know, Laura and Danielle and everybody down here who's involved with all that, Jess and of course Don.
Yeah,
you know, we just it's really important to us that we support that sort of thing because you know, national coordinator, he's right down the road. You know, it only makes perfect sense. I mean, you just go to the weekend, you know, the OCR, Orientation to Cave Rescue. Mm-hmm. And whether you have any interest in cave rescue whatsoever, you really should go because it just makes you a better caver. It makes you better to go caving with. It makes you yourself a better caver for yourself because you become sort of hyper aware of all the risks and all the things that could happen and all the ways that it could go horribly wrong. And then you learn to prevent that.
Right. It's a big eye opener.
Huge. And you learn that self-rescue is extremely important if you could possibly swing it. You know, you run into trouble, you better try to self-rescue before you get any help.
Yeah. And speaking of self-rescue, NCRC's just started a new program called SPAR, which is Small Party Assisted Rescue.
Hmm.
And what we do with that is we have either a 3 or 4 day class, or we just started a week long class at the National Week Long Seminar, where we teach folks that are more not interested in the agency side of rescue, more just the regular caver. You know, the guys that are going out surveying caves, finding caves, you know, doing the 14-hour trips, push trips, you know, pushing leads, and how to rescue someone that has an injury that doesn't necessarily require a big turnout from the rescue squad and fire department. And, you know, all you really need is, you know, maybe 4 or 5 cavers just to assist somebody out of the cave.
Yeah.
So that's what that class is specifically designed for. And it's been really popular and really pretty successful. And I'd like to see a lot more people take it. So I like to promote that one too. I think it's great for just, you know, a lot of people are turned off by the whole agency type rescue where there's an incident commander and a public information officer and all these links in the chain that have to come together. And it's not realistic for a lot of people, a lot of cavers. But, you know, having a twisted ankle or dislocated shoulder in a cave, that's real for everybody. It could be something that, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 of your buddies could get you out of the cave safely and relatively easily if you know some of the techniques we've been working on. So,
yeah,
like that, you know, want to encourage everybody to take one of the SPAR classes. They're pretty great.
Where can we find a schedule?
Yeah, they're on the NCRC website, which is ncrc.info. They pop up all over the country. Don't know where the next one is going to be. We just had one in May that was the week long in Georgia. There is one in September out in Oregon. There's going to be one in Texas in February, I think the first week of February. And there'll be others spread around. There should be some on the East Coast either this winter or the spring. So, yeah, keep an eye on the NCRC website.
SPAR program sounds like I did the weekend, the OCR,
right.
And it just seemed like a lot, you know, it seemed like a big deal. Surely not every cave rescue has to, you know, we don't have to run communications. We're not dragging a litter through.
Right.
And of course they do that for the mock rescue because it's sort of a worst case scenario kind of thing.
Right.
But the SPAR, that sounds great because it's like most rescues are going to be like that. You're dealing with a minor injury. The person's going to need help getting out. And you got to know how to deal with that. You got to know how to dress a wound or an injury and then help them self-rescue essentially.
Right.
And there's technique involved with it. That's terrific.
There's a lot of decision making that goes into figuring out whether you can actually do a self-rescue or not. So we've spent a lot of time discussing that and how to process that. So, it's good stuff.
We touched a little bit on this on the PAX episode, which we did last year. And thank you for your help with that. That was all you. You conducted those interviews. And then I interviewed you, and, you know, we kind of touched on this, but just as sort of a recap, and we can even dig into it further. So what then brought you from just serious caver to cave pack manufacturer? Like, you saw a need and you looked into it and then you did it. I mean,
yeah,
that's a lot. That's big.
Yeah. Basically it was born out of frustration.
Yeah.
Specifically, there was a cave, another Northeast Tennessee cave that called Holt. It's a cave that's right alongside this country road, and there's a parking lot right in front of it. There's space for, you know, 10, maybe 12 cars there, and locals would go there and party. You know, the nice cool air came out of the entrances right by the parking lot, and they brought in a burn barrel, and, you know, they park their cars and drink and smoke and have a great old time. So we started looking at the cave, and it's about 1,000-foot entrance crawl through a stream, so it's not easy to get into.
Nothing that the partiers would have gone for.
No, but we did have to leave somebody out with the car on every trip that was armed. Oh, because the parties got pretty serious.
Where was this?
It was in East Tennessee.
Okay, all right.
Back in the boonies.
Just hill people.
Oh, yeah.
Throwing parties.
Just the locals going down there to have a party.
So was it a short straw situation, or did you have a friend who was a non-caver who was happy to wait with the car with a gun?
Well, yeah, he was an older caver that didn't want to do the 1,000-foot crawl.
Okay.
But he was a good old boy, too, and he could hang with the partying folks. So
spoke the language.
Yeah, exactly.
So to speak.
So, yeah, he volunteered to stay out there. He would tell some interesting stories when we got out, you know, gunfire and fights. And, oh, my God. But, yeah, so anyway, we started doing this cave. We did it a couple times, surveyed some of it. We're still not done surveying it, but, you know, the 1,000-foot crawl, I was using a Lost Creek bag at the time, and that cave just did it for me. It's like, I can't carry this pack anymore. It's not working. For one thing, it was like a sponge, soaked up all the water in the stream passage. Yeah, I could put a dry bag inside and keep my stuff dry, but it still absorbed water and made it twice as heavy as it was. And the straps, you know, we're flopping all over the place, and the buckles would get caught on things, and you couldn't tighten it down enough, and it was floppy and wouldn't roll. You couldn't push it. It would get caught on everything if you tried to drag it. So I decided I was going to try to come up with something better. You know, and I had seen some of the folks with the PVC bags that just roll down closure PVC bags. They're basically just a tube with a roll down closure on the top. And wasn't very impressed with those. They seemed to be too big for my needs. So I wanted something smaller, lower profile, more durable and waterproof and simpler. So I just started messing around, you know, back of the envelope sketches where I'd just eliminate pieces and parts and stuff that wasn't absolutely necessary. You know, and I ended up with a flat, not really flat, but I sewed up a flat tube, I guess you could call it, and then sewed straps right into the seam. So there were no buckles, no adjustments, just absolutely as simple as it could be, with a roll down closure. Messed around with that. I made it out of an old sheet just for proof of concept.
Sure.
And then I went to the fabric store and asked them for some waterproof fabric, and they didn't know what I was talking about. Why would you want waterproof fabric? So,
and then you didn't feel like explaining the rest of it.
Yeah.
Never mind.
So I ended up somewhere. I can't remember exactly where it was, but I got some PVC coated material. And yeah, I knew it wasn't going to be great, but it was waterproof. So I sewed it up and did it. So it was kind of flat, you know, similar to the current Swago design. But I turned it inside out, so the seams were on the inside, like most packs and sure. bags are. And, you know, sewed the straps in, no buckles, very simple. And took it on the first caving trip to Holt Cave for that 1,000-foot stream crawl. Pulled it in there, dragged it a lot, and pushed it a lot. And it was doing pretty good. I was kind of liking it. And by the time we got out, you know, I was showing everybody the pack, and it was just full of holes. Probably had 10, 15 holes in it that had worn in the first trip.
Not so quite
durable. I needed something more durable. So I got on the internet and searching around, and I had heard that Hypalon material was pretty tough. I didn't really know what it was, but I had heard that name and knew it was strong stuff. So searching around for that, and found a company in California that made pond liners out of Hypalon. So I called them, and the lady was nice enough to listen to my story and sympathetic enough that she said, all right, well, send me a drawing of what you want, and I'll try to see if I can put something together for you. I was like, man, this is fantastic. So I sent her some sketches, and about 3 weeks later, she sent me this bag, and she said, you know, I didn't sew it for you. We heat seal all our seams on the pond liner, so I just sealed the seams for you. Like, wow, that is cool. You know, you don't have to sew it, and it's watertight. This is great. So I used that for a little while, and it did pretty good. And then, you know, more research, finding better materials, and
so was
tweaking
this,
the design a little bit.
Was this for personal use initially, and you were just kind of like, I'm just going to make something for myself, and you know,
yeah, just
hadn't
for
really
myself.
Thought to sell it.
Right. Yeah, I didn't think about selling it until it was that first pack that got all the holes in it. I went to a bachelor party, and my buddy Kevin was there. He and I had caved together a lot in high school and in after college in West Virginia. So I showed him that pack that had all the holes in it, and he's looking at it. He's like, yeah, that's kind of interesting. And he put it on, and he put it on upside down. You know, I said, look at you, you jackass. It's upside down. And then I looked at it, and I had that eureka moment. And I was like, wow, look at that. You know, it's upside down. It moves the bulk of the pack down between your shoulder blades and into your lower back instead of up above your shoulders.
Yeah.
And so now you could duck under stuff and be more low profile. It's like, wow. You know, went back and redid the design and made a prototype, and realized I couldn't fit my Nalgene bottle in it sideways. So I went back and made it a little wider so a Nalgene bottle would fit in it sideways. So a bunch of little tweaks like that, and eventually got it to what the pit pack was, the smallest version.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's pretty much how it evolved.
And then, you know, you produced them for how long before you ran into the supply issue? I can't remember when the first Swago pack was made and sold.
Yeah, we sold the first one at OTR in 2003.
Okay. So you had about a good 10-12 year run?
Yeah.
Before the supply issue? I guess it was 13 years. And then ran into the supply issue because you were making it out of a material, if I remember correctly, that was used for collapsible kayaks.
Right. Well, the collapsible kayak company was ordering the material from the mill, and they would order, you know, huge quantities.
Yeah.
And they were able to meet the minimum order requirements. And I would just, they would call me when they made an order and say, hey, you want any? I was like, yeah, add me 2 or 3 rolls onto your order. And, you know, they were ordering 50, 100 rolls at a time. So it was no big deal for them. And I'd just pay them for the extra rolls. And it worked great. And then they called me in fall of 2016 and said, hey, we're not going to make that boat anymore. So we don't need that material. Sorry.
Oh, God.
So.
But have things changed a little bit? I mean, you were doing some prototype packs, and actually a couple people I know got a hold of them. Raymond Mal got a hold of one.
Right.
Laura Demarest got a hold of one or two. and yep. and some other people. You were shopping around some material. Did you end up happy with any of that?
Well, yeah, I've been looking for material for about 2 years now, and I think it might be safe to go ahead and announce on your podcast that I have found some material. So Swago packs are coming back.
Are they really?
Woo-hoo, yeah.
Great. So proud to be the place where you make that announcement. That's fantastic. So what'd you end up finding? What'd you end up using?
So I got a sample from a company in Connecticut that they do a lot of aerospace fabric, actually. Aerospace and inflatables, you know, like the Goodyear blimp, that kind of stuff.
Fascinating.
So they had a fabric that looked pretty cool. So I got some samples, made some test packs. I sent one of the test packs to Laura. She's been testing it out a little bit. She's given me some good feedback on it. I've been testing one, dragging it around, and it's holding up pretty good. So I placed an order for some material, and the material should be here in about 2 weeks.
Wow. Fantastic.
So we're going to start making some more.
So do you make it the same way as the old one, or is it different? Because you said the old one was a heat seal.
Yeah, same exact process.
It's the same process. Okay.
Yep. Just going to be a different material. Yeah, this material is actually a little shinier. You know, the old packs were kind of a dull matte finish.
Yeah.
This has more of a gloss finish, so that's going to be the biggest difference.
It's just way it looks? I mean, a few trips, it's not going to look that great. Or does it hold the shine?
Not as good as new, but you know, you wipe it off. It'll still shine a little bit.
Yeah. Man, yeah. So now everybody's going to be in a race to dull up their Swago packs, their shiny Swago packs. Look how many trips this one's been through. Look how many trips. Yeah. So is it still black, or is it you're going to offer multiple? Okay.
Nope, still black. They only offer it in black.
And this supplier, is it going to be a little easier for you to order fabric? Or are you channeling kind of like you were before through another manufacturer to get scraps or additional fabric? Or how are we securing the legacy of Swago here?
I think we're in a little bit better position now because this company, they don't stock it. They don't keep it on the shelf, but they run this particular material two or three times a year. Mm. So I guess they have enough customers that use it that they need to run it a couple or three times a year. And they said anytime they're running it, they're happy to add a roll or two on for me. So it should work out pretty good. And they've been making that material for, a number of years, 15 years or so. And they said they plan on continuing making it. So it should be a pretty good source.
This is such fantastic news, Scott.
Yeah, I know.
This is so great.
It's hard to believe it's actually happening.
I mean, when I saw on Facebook recently, I saw the pink and the purple and the blue straps. Maybe it was blue. I can't remember, but I saw that
pink,
and I was like,
purple and black.
Pink, purple, and black. I said, those look like Swago straps.
Yeah.
Those look like, what's going on? Are we making packs again or what?
Well, that was in the works for, several months. I thought, I got to sell something.
Just to keep the
brand feasible. So, people had asked me for different color straps for years. And, I finally just bit the bullet, bought some straps, some webbing, and made some straps. And so pink, purple, and black. Webbing and beaners. So the black, if you want to go tactical or stealth mode.
Yeah.
So.
That's so fantastic. So you said you're a couple weeks out from getting the material.
Yeah. So I can tell you the exact schedule. What's going to happen is the podcast will come out August 1st, correct?
Yeah, that's right.
So August 1st, the packs will be available for pre-order on swagogear.com and Intermountain Outfitters website.
Okay. So IMO, the exclusive first run.
Yes. Nice. Well, pre-order, exclusive pre-order.
Pre-order, yeah.
So they will be available for 10 days, August 1st through August 10th. For pre-orders.
I think you're going to get inundated, my friend. You're going to be busy for a few weeks.
It could be.
It might be an issue.
So then the next weekend after the 10th is Cave Capers, which you're very familiar with.
Of course.
So I will be there at Cave Capers and to deliver packs that have been pre-ordered.
Oh, my gosh.
And so will Intermountain Outfitters.
Yeah.
So Intermountain Outfitters will have a limited supply on hand for sale for people who just show up at Capers that want to buy one that did not pre-order.
Wow.
So if you don't pre-order, you can still get one at Capers.
Those are going to go day one. Just so you know, we open registration at noon on Friday.
Okay. So
a lot of people who have been to multiple Capers just show up Thursday night and don't even ask permission. They don't even so they'll probably buy them out Thursday night. Who knows? Who knows?
But
we'll see.
Yep.
That's so great.
Yeah. So then for everybody else that can't make it to Capers, they'll be available on swagergear.com, Intermountain Outfitters, August 22nd.
August 22nd. Okay.
Yep.
So the week, sort of the weekend or, like late in the week after Capers.
Yeah. It's like I think it's the Wednesday after Capers.
Wednesday. Yeah. That makes sense. Wednesday after Capers. Capers is 17th through the 19th. Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah.
So have you done any sort of demand calculation to see how busy you're going to be in the next month and a half?
No, because I've been trying to keep it kind of secret. So. Just kind of shooting from the hip here.
Yeah, that's kind of what you got to do. You don't go to business school to sell cave packs. That's for sure.
Right.
Yeah. Man, that's fantastic. So you're back at it. Are you doing new sizes? Are you doing anything else that's new, or is it pretty much the old?
No, they're going to be the same size, same names, just shiny instead of dull.
Gotcha.
So the new prices will be $129, $139, $149.
I can't wait. I just can't wait. And you're coming to Capers. And so do you have any plans when you come to Capers? Are you going to see anything cool we got here in Indiana? Have you made any plans with anybody?
Yeah. I would love to go caving. Need to make some plans. So, yeah, whatever. I'm up for anything.
Yeah. Well, that's fantastic news. So this is sort of culminating in literally years. Like you've been looking for a couple of years, you know, for new material, right? Like you've been going to trade shows and stuff.
Oh yeah.
I mean, this is a serious business.
Yeah, searched the country basically. Took almost two years to find it.
And you're happy with it?
Yeah. Yeah, I like it.
Because I've seen some of the reviews on some of the other stuff and you know, and people were like, you know what? Yeah, this is good. And had this been the only thing that we knew before, we would like it. But the stuff that he had before was great. But now you got something comparable and it's going to, and it's really going to work out. And Swagos are back, baby.
Yeah. Woohoo.
So there you have it. Pretty exciting, huh? Swagos are back. Visit swagogear.com to work on that pre-order or plan to come to Indiana Cave Capers, and maybe you'll get your hands on that first run from Jeff and Nina with Intermountain Outfitters when they come up here to Indiana Cave Capers. And again, you can pre-register for Indiana Cave Capers at cigcaves.com, cigcaves.com. Don't forget the banquet ticket and a number of other extras, including shirts made by Charlie. So excited that Swagos are coming back and so proud to be a small part of the big relaunch of Swago Packs. As always, support the podcast by supporting caving. Kick a little extra to your local grotto or the NSS, or support our sponsors, past and present. Swagogear.com, of course. Get that pre-order in. And Organic Robot on Etsy. Charlie will be at Capers and OTR with shirts. Or again, order online at the Etsy store. Just search Organic Robot, all one word, Organic Robot. Or contribute to me directly on Patreon, patreon.com/cavingpodcast. It's a lot of work to put this podcast out every month. I love it, but a little goes a long way there. All proceeds, of course, go right back into caving in the form of memberships to Cave and Karst Conservancies in the podcast name. patreon.com/cavingpodcast. I'm Matt Pelser, chairman of the Central Indiana Grotto. Until next time, kill nothing but time.